This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers, thanks guys, Patreon tipsters, thanks guys, and Audio Boom. Stay tuned for exciting podcast updates about all three of these things right after the intro, and here's where I shut up and deal.
To be honest, I'm not worried about the moral issue here. I'm worried about the... if she's caught doing that, you know, she's finished.
It's never happened before in 20-some-odd years. The only way anything can happen is if she...
someone talks.
One of the minds behind MTV's unsung wrongful conviction investigation show, Unlocking the Truth, brings us a podcast about the college admissions bribery scandal, gangster capitalism, and the other mind besides mind behind the Go Pirates podcast brings us some insight into the cheating scandal that rocked competitive bridge in 2016 and may continue to do so. Grab some gin, you rummies. It's John Ramos returning for The Blotter Presents, episode 110. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast devoted to the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. Very good at bridge is my guest, John Ramos. Hi, John.
Hi, Sarah. Would you believe this is the first podcast about bridge I have ever participated in?
No. That's wrong.
John Ramos.
Would you believe that the Go Pirates soundboard is entirely intact and I was able to pull the John Ramos clip with no problem at all? I'm sure you would believe that, actually. That really does seem like an oversight on the part of the universe. We will get back to that. But first, and before we brainstorm a new term for Trump in various card games, because that shit is overdue, I have a little podcast business. All right, the big headline is that The Blotter Presents is now a part of the Audio Boom Network. This is very good news for me and probably means some coupon codes for you, dear listeners, so stay tuned for those as we head into the autumn. What this also means, though, is that we'll be experiencing a little changeover agita as the podcast is physically moving onto a different host. So if you're having issues, ping me. Still Blotter Presents across all social media. Or email me, that's bunting@the-blotter.com. In other site business, I'm also off next week, mostly to get my feet under me with the switchover, but feel free to roll around in the archives or visit the blog, that's the-blotter.com. There's lots of material there, including a new book review from Mark Blankenship about Cynthia Rowe's memoir. And speaking of book reviews, if you are a member of the Patreon crew, you will be getting two book reviews this week, including one of Bank Robbery Chronicle Norco 80, which went up on Monday. You'll be voting on next month's book reviewee, and thanks to the generosity of Scott J., anyone who follows me on Twitter at Blotter Presents will be, quote, enjoying a live tweet of a woman scorned the Betty Broderick story on Thursday, September 5th. That begins at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. So watch the Blotter social for a link to the film on YouTube. I can't believe it just called it a film. What am I doing? If you want to watch in parallel or pre-watch or talk about the book, etc. and so on, Blotter Presents across all social media, including our Instagram. And if you want to make me live tweet true crime properties of yesteryear that you choose, or properties of today, your call, that is a Patreon extra. Look into that at, you guessed it, patreon.com/blotterpresents. Okay, not that John isn't used to sitting patiently while I monologue, but that's enough of that. Let's get into our most wanted topic with the Gangster Capitalism podcast. Here is the case file from the Wikipedia page for the 2019 college admissions bribery scandal, which, of course, has its own Wikipedia page. What a world. Quote, 33 parents of college applicants are accused of paying more than $25 million between 2011 and 2018 to one William Rick Singer, organizer of the scheme, who used part of the money to fraudulently inflate entrance exam test scores and bribe college officials. End quote. Gangster Capitalism, a Cadence 13 podcast, is co-produced and co-written by Zach Levitt and Andrew Jenks, the latter of whom is a wunderkind documentarian who also produced a Wrongful Conviction true crime show that basically only I cared about. It was on MTV a few years ago, and it was called Unlocking the Truth. It was hosted by exoneree Ryan Ferguson, who really actually had quite a gift and a charisma for hosting. I wish he were hosting this. Okay, so John, I wanted to talk to you about this because we attended the same schmancy university, and I remember when all of this started breaking, saying to you that I was a little surprised that Princeton had not gotten its hand caught in this particular cookie jar, and I believe it was you who said, oh, they were doing it, they just bury the bodies deeper. Is that your still your general impression of this?
It's hard to say, honestly. I mean, having been, you know, steeped in so much privilege there, nothing would really surprise me, I don't think. But
yeah.
At the same time, I think, yeah, Princeton would maybe not be quite this clumsy about it.
Yeah, I do feel that Princeton generally is better at you know, being crooks.
I mean, I guess I could talk
perhaps
myself,
the best.
Yeah, I guess I could talk myself around to the other. You know, they get so much money from donors, and their endowment is so big that maybe they just don't need it on this kind of, you know. I hesitate to use the word petty, given so much money, given how much money was involved, but still, on the scale of like an Ivy League endowment, it's smaller potatoes. So maybe I feel like it could have happened. It's not an ethical, you know, it doesn't speak to Princeton's ethics that it didn't happen there if it didn't. It's just that it probably, you know, it happens in ways that are more on the technically legal side.
Well, yeah, there is an interviewee in this podcast who mentions, I forget the term that's used, institutional. It's like institutional giving, I think. And right. It may actually be the clip that we heard up top was one of the reenactments of transcripts of these phone taps that that the podcast uses, which they seem very effective, like, that, you know, generally well acted and believable and not too melodramatic. But yeah, that. I suspect that there are various like labs and buildings and, you know, crew boat storage facilities that perhaps eased the matriculation of various freshmen over the years. But, you know, when you mentioned privilege before, my sort of response to all of this when we were first learning about it is that, you know, this is happening on various levels all the time anyway, from, you know, going to private schools to just like having, like, you know, growing up in a comfortable family, never having to worry about like violence in the home or going hungry. Like, I, you know, did not grow up in a food desert. I had a new bike every 2 years. Mm-hmm. My brother had SAT tutors because his entire class had them at his private prep school. Like, none of this was surprising. It was just a little more extreme and clumsily done, like you said.
Right.
So, I unfortunately, like, you know, you and I having grown up on the East Coast, you didn't go to a private school, but you went to a sort of named New York high school. You were on an athletic track. Da 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 da. We sort of are not inured to this, but it certainly wasn't perhaps all that shocking to us. So I wasn't sure how the podcast was going to frame it. Like, you know, is this going to be like really a review of everything that happened? Are they going to unpack exactly what the crime was? And it was like a little bit of both, but it took a while to get going for me. What did you think of the pacing?
Agree. I mean, the first episode I found really soggy, to be honest. There was so much that just went on too long and also wasn't particularly informative. And the I kind of cracked up at the doc, but like the whole, you know, quote reenactment of his buttonholing singer at the pool in Florida is such a waste of the medium. I mean,
oh my God, really?
And it just goes on forever too. I mean, well, I guess in a technical sense it was, but not really. I mean, for the listener who has not listened to the podcast, basically, you know, the entire episode is supposedly leading up to this big like confrontation he has with Singer, somewhat through, you know, he gets a tip, you know, kind of through happenstance that Singer is hanging out at this public pool in Florida. So he and I guess a journo friend or maybe a camera person or something go and,
or maybe like a local PI. I was not
right. It was not clear. And all we hear is just him asking, quote, Singer questions, and getting no response other than the very loud and lengthy jingling of keys and engine starting.
I mean, I'm just going to jump ahead and play this clip because this is the kind of showing your work, doorstepping of like a key source who everybody knows isn't going to talk to you, but because it's an audio medium, you have to like, you know, show the work. And then it just keeps going, and it's like it's like season 3 of American Vandal. Like this is a Wunderkind director, like I said, but he is, you know, in his 30s now, and this is just some student shit right here. That's like, we, you know, unless we're given reason to think otherwise, we believe that you tried to contact him and naturally got no comment because he's out on bail and he's not an idiot. So here's clip 4.
So I went back the very next day and I asked him another set of questions.
Rick, can any good come from this? Rick, can any good? Have you exposed deeper flaws in the educational world? Is the system broken? Just gonna have to keep coming here, man.
Ooh.
Gonna keep having you come every day. Is the system broken? Any comment on anything? You seem pretty comfortable.
I mean,
it's the second time. I mean, to me, like,
I almost quit the podcast at that point.
There was a real implied promise that the second visit would get somewhere, and the fact that it didn't was just like, Jesus Christ. Like,
well, yeah, I wasn't even that put off by, because, you know, Singer, like I said, I mean, he got caught, but I'm not sure it was his stupidity that led to that. And it's like, okay, I did find myself thinking during this sequence, which was interminable. We only heard like 40% of it. Net.
Oh, then there's like there's a music cue at the end that really wants to make us think this was way more important than it was. But
well, I'm like, I'm siding with Singer here, because then I started thinking about it that I was like, you know, I think, you know, I do think that a lot of the outrage in this case that is directed against Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman, there is an unattractive, like, top note of sexism to it. And this, like, sort of bottled up resentment of, like, rich moms that I don't think is directed at the dads at all, even though I think in Lori Loughlin's case, like, her husband was probably the primary bad actor. But anyway, to, you know, coin a phrase.
Yeah.
But There's like, they read some email from Felicity Huffman. I didn't pull this quote, but her response included something to the effect of, "Ruh-roh, this isn't good," because some scam that they were trying to pull with a proctor failed. And there was something about the "Ruh-roh" that was infuriating and made me want to punch her. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm also a sexist about this, but like, as far as Rick Singer is concerned, it's like, this system is already so tilted towards privilege that why shouldn't he take advantage of stupid rich people? Like, I don't know. Like, there was something about this sequence where the documentarian was being so performatively documentarian that I'm like, don't make me side with Rick Singer. And then I was kind of like, all right, but why shouldn't I? Like, someone was going to step into this breach and do what he did.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to be honest, I think, you know, if I were to suggest to the listener, I would probably skip the first episode entirely, even if you are mm-hmm. interested, because there's no way you're not familiar with the relevant parts of it. And there were a couple,
yeah,
there were a couple of, oh, by the way, you know, facts that, you know, were like, you know, like the part where they mentioned that the bribes, you know, went through a quote nonprofit company and as such were tax deductible too.
Yeah.
Was really like a processing detail. And I was like, Jesus Christ.
Double dip dickery. Yeah. Classic.
But beyond that, you know, I think it's a real miss, you know, but.
Yeah. The first one, I will play clip three, because there's a Lori Loughlin stan who reveals some hard truths about why this became and stayed such a big story, and why she's still such a Lori Loughlin stan in spite of it all. So let me back up to clip three.
The first is Lori Loughlin, best known as Aunt Becky from Full House.
We just saw Lori Loughlin and she smiled at us and waved us and loved us.
She's so beautiful.
She's our celebrity mom. We love her. She was all smiles. She seemed so happy and positive. Like,
she's a positive.
No, I'm being completely serious. She was smiling at us. She literally saw our masks that we have of her face and she thought it was great. Like, she loved us.
She was smiling, all smiles.
And I just honestly want to hug her so bad. If you're really surprised that this is a thing that people are bribing their colleges to get their children in, then I'm sorry, where have you been? Everyone knows the rich is corrupt. It's been like that forever. Not supporting her actions, but like, it's Aunt Becky and I wanted to meet her and she smiled at me and I'm happy. Bye.
I mean, she's right.
Yeah, she's right. And she's also like, look, this is a beloved character from my childhood who, like, gave me positive reinforcement. And what matters more in 2019 America than getting, you know, your love reflected back to you by a celebrity? Basically nothing.
Totally.
So, yeah, I thought that... her being like, okay, the actual issues in these cases are non-issues that everybody has just like sort of accepted as the cost of doing business, which is depressing, but like, it's true. I think that's most people's attitude, and it was what we were just saying before.
It is true. What I was hoping for, I should say, I only listened to two episodes, and I think there are six in the season.
I think it's continuing. I also only listened to two because I felt like, you know, will I come back to this? Maybe, but...
I think what I was hoping most for was, like, some way to link this scandal, some analysis of whether the scandal is, like, part of, like, what feels like a more progressive movement in... the country of people just being no longer willing to bend to the will of people who have unlimited money. And episode two gave me some hope that it would touch on like larger issues like that. I mean, I think episode two is way better than episode one.
Yeah, it is. You do hear from, maybe it's before that. that little fucker, Olivia Jade.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's episode two. And that famous clip where she's like, I don't really care about the school part, TBH. And you're like, oh, word. Whatever. Like, she's not my problem. I just love, like, that she's basically at war with her mother.
Yeah.
Over this hilarious. Because her parents thought she was too big of a dumbass fuck off to do well in school. And what do you know? Although she was doing fine for herself. She doesn't really need anyone's help. She's pretty and she gets Instagram ads, so mm-hmm. fine. She's not taking my money, so I don't care. But I think there is a larger movement in the country that's like the fact that to get higher education is both necessary and punishingly expensive is part of the like baked in racism and classism of the entire system. And that presidential candidates are talking about forgiveness of student loan debt and so on and so forth, and punishing credit card companies for putting those leaflets in the mm-hmm. mail room. I don't know if there even are mail rooms anymore. We are old. But
is there mail? I don't
I know. Yeah. To quote unquote mail. I think that there's definitely this bottom that has been hit in people's tolerance for the status quo on this level.
Right.
I will also say we'll get back to the hypocrisy of sort of calling attention to this and then not at the same time calling the NCAA to account in a moment. One of my favorite rants, as you know, but I did want to talk a little bit about this concept. There's a girls' school in LA that they talked to the head of, Dr. Priscilla Sands. Mm-hmm. She's in clip five.
Marlboro School, yeah.
Yes, which I'm about to play. And she's talking about this idea that, like, who is this good for? Like, it's a bumper sticker mentality, which I think is the title of the episode. And like that, this is all about the parents needing a status symbol. It's not about what's good for the kid, that helicopter parenting doesn't allow kids to sort of feel a loss or a setback and figure out how to self-soothe. This is something that as a university instructor of highly talented and precocious students, I was forced to contemplate. She raised some interesting issues about that in clip five.
You know, on some fundamental level, I'm not sure these parents, for the most part, thought that they were doing, I don't want to say anything wrong, but it's a slippery slope. We love them. But a lot of love means you set some hard boundaries, you give them independence, you don't try and micromanage. Who says Harvard's the right school for your child? And then if she doesn't get in, she's feeling loss, and it is profound. I have let my parents down. I am not worthy. I am not good enough.
I mean, I will tell you, despite having met you there, an acquisition I treasure in my life, I don't think I would go to Princeton again. But I went because it was kind of a fuck you to everybody who had made fun of me for being smart for 12 years. And my parents were extremely thrilled and proud, and they could pay. So, this really resonated with me, and I think that that's a really, it's not great. And it's also sort of like, well, you know, boohoo privileged kids who don't know how to cope with not getting what they want, but it's like, do they even know what they want? And who is benefiting from this system really, if they get into Harvard and then they hate it there?
Right. I mean, I was really struck by that entire sequence with her, too. I think it's Dr. Sands, I think, is the woman's name. Although I believe that is an actor playing her. But, you know, she kind of laid bare this double whammy of there's so much pressure on these kids to perform, but there's also no agency in the decisions that they make.
Right.
So that does not lead to happy, confident people, you know?
Yeah.
It's funny. I've seen the same thing, you know, in a different setting, but I've seen the same thing as a junior tennis player. I saw so much of this from tennis parents too, you know, controlling, you know, making the kids, you know, living through their kids, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's why so many tennis, I just heard unbelievable numerous stories, including one that I knew personally from Princeton, that they, as soon as they got recruited and got into the college that they wanted, they quit playing tennis forever. It was just a means to do that. And it's kind of sad because, you know, to be that good, you have to put in so much time and so much effort. And I guess that end justified the means, but maybe not, is I think her point, you know, in getting back to the academic sense. So, yeah.
Well, and I think that's like, and then this sort of rolls on the podcast into a discussion of the way that the various athletic departments were also gamed into holding like recruitment and scholarship spots for coxswains on the rowing team, for kickers on the football team. And then these kids would like, quote, have an injury or just not, you know, not like walk on, but then not do anything. And there were kids, like there's a, you know, there was a program out west to try to get kids interested in and good at rowing.
Yeah, Row LA, I think it was
yeah, called. Because yeah. I mean, we all saw Oxford Blues, like that is a straight shot into the heart of the old school, is mm-hmm. Is crew. So and then Olivia Jade and I think also her sister end up taking spots from kids, like that was their shot, and they would work 4 years so that they could get a rowing scholarship to USC, and then they're gonna get axed out by someone who has no intention of even going to class, never mind getting up at 5 a.m. to yell at people while they're rowing, which, you know, that maybe you just don't want to go to college. Like, and you, I mean, saw this in my peer group growing up, and it was even worse by the time my brother, who's 5 years younger, got to be college application age. Just like, there wasn't a single free minute ever. Everybody's overscheduled. There's tutors, there's lessons, there's like, let's say take some pictures of you in your lacrosse uniform, because that people care about that. Like,
I mean, why? When the one male kid was, quote, kid, whatever, who knows how old the actor playing him was, but was detailing his daily schedule, it was really giving me PTSD. And I don't think I was scheduled as heavily as he was, but it was still, it was hard to listen to. Like, just the amount of sleep. I mean, it got, I remember how tiring those days were, you know. Like, I mean, yes, you're young, you can cope with a lot, but 5 hours of sleep is not a whole lot, you know. And no. I knew people who regularly got less in high
same.
School. So, yeah.
Yeah, same, because not everybody, like there were certain subjects that I could backstroke. But you know, not everything, and I'm running the lit mag, and I'm being a little league umpire, which was a fucking misery across a number of axes, and talk about some shitty sports parenting. Oh my God. So I'm witnessing that while
I can only imagine if we're talking sexism too, I can imagine you got a fair amount of that.
The kids couldn't have given less of a shit if they were dead. The parents were all like, I mean, there was some language.
Well, I think where this episode was, really strong, but you know, what I was hoping out of this podcast is something that I think the last 15 minutes of the episode delivers, which is a way deeper dive into stuff that, you know, even media reporting, I think, didn't really want to talk about at the time, which is, you know, bringing race into the mix and looking at the difference, you know, the similarities and differences between the recruiting of black male athletes. it's pernicious and self-fulfilling too, because if these, you know, crew yokels are taking up all these spots at privileged colleges, that just reinforces the idea, both stereotype, it's a stereotype, but you know, this whole scandal shows how true it is that the only way in for black males is to be an athlete.
It's yeah.
self-fulfilling, right? So,
and that so many of these schools, especially, I mean, having married a North Carolina Tar Heel and rooted since that time for their basketball team, it's like, you know, if you care about any Division I sport or even Division II sport, like any college sports, it's like this is all over it. And nowhere more so than the Ivy League.
Before Certainly. We move on, just so we can move on, should we? Do you want to give your three-word mantra on college athletes?
Pay the athletes.
Yep.
It's actually four words. Pay the fucking athletes.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah. Let me play a clip. There's a fairly long sequence talking to journalist Kevin Blackstone, who... Not for nothing, but I would really prefer that he host this because he makes a lot of good points, A, but B, and possibly more importantly, he has a pretty sexy voice. I mean, I could only be what I am. I guess I shouldn't have been paying attention to that, but Kevin Blackstone, come and read me things and tell me what to think.
I want you in my ears.
Yes, except I already agreed with you in your thoughts in our final clip in this section.
And without that revenue, you wouldn't be able to have these other sports. Oh, they might exist, but the volleyball team would not be flying across country to play another volleyball team. Title IX would not look like it does today. So that's another insidious outgrowth of all of this, that the wealthy white families and well-connected white families involved in this college admission scandal were doing so from the largesse of black male labor.
Couldn't have said it better myself, and will not try. I think that this podcast, I absolutely agree with you. Skip the first episode because there's a lot of just like narrative throat clearing and kind of performative garbage time tape. And he doesn't, when he lets the interviewees talk, and when he just uses like source materials and what people are telling him who are in a position to know from various standpoints inside the system or outside because it's their job to analyze it, it's very strong. And I do want to keep going with the podcast. I'm not sure when I'm going to get to it, but I think my next long car trip, I'm going to finish it out because I think he does get a lot of good talking head interviews. And I think there's, you know, this is a story that we should all kind of sit with, especially the uncomfortable parts.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, I've never used this term to describe a podcast series before, but I think the first episode is very piloty.
Yes. yeah, it is.
And now that we've listened to it, you don't have to. But I, too, am interested in moving on at least to hear another episode and see if it's more representative of episode two. Because if it is, I think it's definitely a worthwhile sit.
Yeah, for sure.
And there's a lot more, you know, as I mentioned before, I think there's a lot more fertile ground and wider conclusions that could be drawn. And I would love to see if the podcast actually does that. So.
Well, and I think also... in Jenks's and Levitt's defense, like Jenks is a like sort of quote unquote traditional video documentary guy. Like
right.
He's not an audio only guy. So he may have just needed half an hour, 40 minutes to like figure out which lane he was supposed to be in and how fast he was supposed to go in it. So it does seem to have settled down. Listeners, if you've been listening all along, and you've gotten to the end, if you agree with our assessment, disagree, want to tell us that episode two was as good as it gets and we shouldn't bother, absolutely let us know. That's Blotter Presents across all social media, as I mentioned.
I mean, there's so much you could do just with football, right? I mean, just thinking about like the reaction to Andrew Luck retiring this weekend. Yeah. And meanwhile, so many people are getting so many worse injuries and, you know, not getting medical. I mean, whatever, you know, I don't need to tell you about concussions in football, but, you know, again, there could be a lot of places this goes that could be interesting and worthwhile is my point.
So, yeah, agree. All right. Speaking of interesting and worthwhile, the Gimelstobs of professional tennis are fucking neither. But since nobody has done us the favor of doing a 30 for 30 or a podcast on these shitheads, John and I could both tell you some stories, but we won't. So we went instead in a long reads direction about the cheating scandal in Bridge, the game, not Chris Christie lying on a beach or closing down the GWB, that was covered in March issues of both Vanity Fair by John Colapinto and The New Yorker by the great David Owen, who, among other things, wrote a whole book called High School, where he went undercover at a high school for like a semester. If you can find it, it's out of print. I recommend it. We'll link to both of those in the show notes, but here's the case file on the actual flap adapted from the Cheating in Bridge Wikipedia page. Quote, in August 2015 at the Chicago NABC, Norwegian player, how do you pronounce this name, Johnny?
Boye Broglund.
Thank you. Okay. Boye Broglund.
That's how you pronounce it in English, I'm sure. Okay. In Swedish.
I was like, Boje Brogaland. Like, I don't even, it's like being in IKEA anyway. Lost a match on appeal against Israeli players Lotan Fischer and Ron Schwartz, his former teammates at the previous North American Bridge Championships. Broglund reviewed the BBO records for the match and became convinced that Fischer and Schwartz were using illegal methods to exchange information about their hands. He went on to publicly accuse them via a website posting. The initiative garnered support from others, and Broglund received tips that other top players were also cheating. Broglund and others investigated further and posted their analyses and conclusions on internet websites, as opposed to paper websites. Wikipedia, sometimes you're funny. Ultimately, this caused teams from Israel, Monaco, and Germany to withdraw from the upcoming 2015 Bermuda Bowl, and a pair from the Polish team had their credentials for that event withdrawn at the last minute. Four partnerships were ultimately sanctioned by their respective government bodies, including Lotan Fischer and Ron Schwartz, Fulvio Fantoni and Claudio Nunes of Italy, Smirnov and Plekarek, who I believe are the Polish pair. And there was another German pair.
Actually, Smirnov and Pekarek are the German pair.
Oh, okay.
And then the Poles are Bliski and Smudzinski. Bliski and Smudzinski.
Okay. of course they are. All right. So, end quote, we are concerning ourselves today with these two long form articles. Like I mentioned, they primarily address the Israeli and Italian pairs, and they try to give an overview of the game of bridge, like sort of generally, and why this is like a big whoop. I mean, because I think that this level of bridge is not what most people think of when they think about bridge. They think about people sitting around with, you know, nut bowls, kibitzing. That is not what it's like, especially at the higher levels. But John has been rattling around at the higher levels of the sport for quite a while now. So I am excited for him to give us some context, and I'm sorry that we couldn't find any material on the Gimelstobs, thereby forcing you to basically give us all a bridge lesson on the microphone. But
I have faith that the Gimelstobs will their day will come.
yeah, alas,
what Justin has been up to for the last year, and it seems inevitable. But,
yeah, seriously. Anyway. So. The Israeli team in particular, I had in our rundown doc, they sound like the Gimelstobs of Bridge. They don't. I don't think they actually hit anyone, although I think one of them like threatened some people, which is like,
yeah, ooh. One of them is not you know, really, really not great. The other one is just kind of a schlub, I think.
There.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about, like, you know, I keep calling it a scandal, but I do think that this qualifies as a crime, because I think money was won and was changing hands under false pretenses and, you know, in an unjust manner. So can you talk a little bit about how, like, teams are constructed and paid for big events, and why cheating makes this more than just like hot goss?
So Bridge has a long and storied history of cheating, I will say. Even back to the 1950s, some of it was more passive and some of it was more active. Like, the passive stuff, you're not allowed to exchange any information with you and your partner without getting too detailed about how that could happen. You were not allowed to have any secret codes between you and your partner when you're describing your hands in the auction, or, you know, anything about what you're, all you can do is bid and play cards, basically.
Everyone has to have whatever information is in play.
Exactly right. Okay. So the way the economies of bridge work these days is that, you know, some bridge professionals make money by teaching, but at these top levels, they are paid to play in tournaments. So, you know, an analog that a lot of people use is, let's say you wanted to play in a doubles tournament and you hired like Roger Federer to play with you, basically.
Okay.
Except the format in bridge is you have a team of four players for the biggest, you know, what's called knockout tournaments, where, you know, just picture an NCAA draw of like 64 teams, except it's bridge. So,
right.
And you have anywhere from four to six players, four play at one time. And there's one person who is the sponsor. So the sponsor is that person who pays for the team, basically. Some sponsors are very bad players. Some sponsors are very good players. It doesn't really matter. It's just what matters is that they can pay. What matters is that they can pay.
Right. To break in, the prize money at a big event is nominal. If
there
is
no prize money,
right?
Actually,
okay.
There's no money in bridge, because if there were, it would be considered gambling and it would not be it would not be legal.
Right, but, right. Okay.
You know, the cost for hiring a team for any, you know, let's say for hiring one pair for the three nationals in a year, it could be anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000. Oh, and, you know, the pairs that get the most results can command higher pay. So
right.
There's definitely incentive for people to be cheating out there, even though there's no official prize money. That is
right. So the crime here would be like fraud, basically.
Yes, basically.
Okay.
So, right. You know, a lot of these sponsors who, you know, later were proven to have hired cheaters, you know, unbeknownst to them, I believe, you know, vacated those trophies. But there's really no precedent for, you know, well, what does it mean if you hired a cheating team? You know, you can't be forced to give up that result necessarily, although a lot of people have.
Right.
You know, another complicating issue is that there are many organizations which govern bridge. There's the World Bridge Federation, but that's like, in terms of power, that would be like, you know, synonymous with the UN. It doesn't really have much actual authority. But the ACBL, American Contract Bridge League, is the governing body that holds all the tournaments in the US and Canada. Now, the ACBL has been accused many, many times of burying its head in the sand when it comes to cheating, and both articles reference that to some degree, but, you know, let's just say, like, what's in the articles doesn't even scratch the surface with how much these pairs were, especially Fischer and Schwartz, were essentially known to be cheating. It was just the method that couldn't be proven until all the stuff that, you know, is detailed in the article happened.
Well, that sort of leads me to my next question. Did you know a lot of the people that were referenced and quoted in these articles?
I would say I personally know about 80% of them.
Okay.
And I've played against a lot of them many times. Yes. Some of them are questions.
So the effect within the game, I mean, well, that's a two-part question. So what was the effect of Brogoland doing this with it from within the game? Because what you're sort of seeing in these articles is someone who sort of may or may not know that much about Bridge. I think in one case, he's definitely like just, you know, reading from the abstract. Mm-hmm. And in the other case, I think he may be a little more familiar with the game. But it's still like a reported perspective from outside, from a reporter from outside. So
for sure.
What was the effect on the game, given that like it was known that these bad actors were doing what they were doing? Was it like Brogoland like posts his website and you're like, finally?
So,
because a lot of the reactions that were quoted in the piece were like, well, this just isn't done in the world of Bridge. You don't accuse somebody even if you know what's going on. Like, what was the reaction really?
So I would say among the really top pros who were playing against them consistently, the result was extreme joy and relief that this was being put out there. But right. Again, it wasn't, you know, it took quite some time to be like actually proven, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt. So during that time, I mean, for one thing, I mean, let's be real. He posted this on the internet. What is the internet full of? A bunch of assholes who have an opinion about everything.
Yes,
so
true.
Even on the site where he posted it, there was a huge debate, and you know, a lot of people were defending him, but you know, just as many, if not more, were saying, "Well, this is not how you do things. This is, you know, you should be, you know." One of the articles references that, you know, a very good player was like, oh, he should be thrown out of Bridge for the way he handled this. Well, you know, ultimately what he did was he had tried to go to the, you know, the relevant authorities many times, fed them tons of information. They dragged their feet and he, you know, eventually decided just blowing it up was the way to go. And he was proven right. But there was no small risk to his reputation and to his, you know, his livelihood, really.
He wound up having to crowdsource. Like, he put a video of their play up and was like, mm-hmm. Anyone? They have to be cheating here, but I don't see it. And then someone finally, like, cracked it. It just sort of reminded me of that couple, like the teacher and his wife who like cracked the Zodiac code over mm-hmm. the weekend.
Yeah.
Like she's just like got her rollers in and she's like, okay, gets out this like maritime dictionary. Anyway,
I think there's a couple
of those videos that we'll have in the show notes that you recommended to illustrate a little more clearly how they got busted.
Right. And it was the sort of thing, you know, there were, you know, the way they position certain cards or the way they position some of the equipment that ironically is designed to, you know, try to make cheating harder was this code
Perfect.
To each other about what they were holding in their hands. And if you're, you know, as a player, you just know that, you know, sometimes these movements aren't precise, but if you look at what they were doing, it was very clear, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it looks very clear, but it just took this international consortium of people watching hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of footage of just people playing Bridge that, you know, in the I guess YouTube is good for something because like before it was routine practice for all these matches to be recorded on video, there was no way this could have been a code this complex could have been broken.
Right. Because the sense I got was that people knew that something was off, but they couldn't quite nail down
exactly right
what it was. So they're just like writing down literally every single thing that happens and waiting for a pattern to emerge, which eventually.
Right. I mean, there were so many indicators. I mean, for one, you know, as one of the articles says, Bridge players are at the top levels are extremely logical. You know, they engage in a lot of inferential thinking, but they don't do things that are contraindicated by, you know, what they've seen up to that point. And there were just many times, every time they took an unusual action, it worked. So statistically, right, it was not possible that they were that good. You know, no one is that good, but no one could prove it. And, you know, imagine playing against a pair with that much money at stake and that much reputation at stake, where you know that they're cheating and yet you can't prove it. It must have been so frustrating for the people that lost to them, which is
well, yeah, especially if that's your livelihood also, and they're sort of like dining out literally.
Exactly.
On how infallible they are, and you're just like losing sponsorships because you can't beat them and you can't prove why.
Right.
How is it still being felt? Does this seem like it's still a current, like it's still current in the world of bridge, or that's sort of like, you know, we got rid of some bad apples and things have returned to a different normal?
I don't think anyone really knows, honestly. I mean, certainly the punishments that were doled out to the pairs in question are sufficiently severe that they would make anyone cheating think twice, I would think. But then again, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to really get into the mind of a cheater that way. You know, like these are all very interesting cases, because like the Fisher Schwartz case and the Fantoni Nunes cases are very different. Schwartz was clearly out of his depth at that level. Fisher was a very good player, but one of the contributing things toward people thinking that they were cheating is that whenever Schwartz had to do something on his own, which is what, you know, when you declare a hand, basically your partner is out of it. Their hand comes down as
right,
and you have to make all the decisions for yourself. His declare a play was much, much worse than the standard at that level. But Fantoni and Nunes were one of the best players in the world for a long time, and both really technically quite good. So what made them cheat? You know, was it just money? Probably not. You know, because they were certainly pulling in enough. They would certainly have pulled in plenty if they were playing it straight. So it's hard to know if the fact that there are deterrents out there will really make people not cheat, or if it's just that they'll try to find a new way. You know,
right?
So no one really knows where we stand.
It seems like one of the articles said that, you know, the bridge world is always looking for ways to like young up, because it's an old rich person's game, and like half the membership probably is set to die off in any given year. I'm exaggerating slightly, but like I make these jokes and you almost never correct me when we're just talking about it. So,
well, I mean, the average age, you know, keeps ticking up. It's over 70 now. So average age, you know.
You're still a whippersnapper is what you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, the story that I dine out on is when I was 23 and played my first tournament, people would say, oh, it's so nice to see young people playing bridge. And now I'm 49 and people are like, oh, it's so nice to see young people playing bridge. So when I stop getting that, I'll know I'm real old.
Yeah, right. Or you look around, you're like, oh, I run bridge now?
Right.
Okay. Neat. But I wonder if some of this wasn't also sort of the world of bridge being like, if this is both seen as a fogey's game and seen as a rigged game, we're gonna die. Do you think that had anything to do with like official response? Do you think that maybe was Brogelin's motivation?
It's interesting, you know,
just like the PR angle.
Well, the Europeans have a different. So in America, bridge has slowly declined in popularity for decades, but in the rest of the world, it's gotten more popular, by far more popular. Actually, bridge is taught in schools in China now. There are a lot of really good Chinese players now. They also have a lot of cheaters, but that's another story. But So I think, you know, coming from a place in Europe where bridge is really, you know, still quite celebrated and is growing, maybe Boye had a different perspective.
Right.
But I think, you know, ultimately, I truly believe that most of these players come by their love of the game completely honestly. It's not cynical just for, you know, just because they're good at it and can make money off of it. So I think Brooklyn's intentions in doing this were about as pure as they could be.
Right.
And, you know, the article alludes to it, but, you know, to several hundred people, you know, going up to him and personally thanking him at all, you know, people of all levels for what he did for Bridge. So
right.
It is certainly a heroic journey. And, you know, it's a pretty fascinating story. I would say we've got our two pieces that are going to be in the show notes. So kind of like our two competing documentaries on the Fire Festival, but I would say, they are quite complementary. The New Yorker piece is, I would say, more technical and gives a lot more context about how Bridge is played. Mm-hmm. But the other one reads more like an actual mystery and gets into, you know, the cat, you know, here are the players, here are the stakes, here's how it was solved, etc. So they're definitely both worth reading, I would say. If it sounds interesting, I would give them both a look.
Yeah, I agree. There is overlap, but in terms of like seeing the same quotes over and over, there's like one overlapping quote from Mextroth.
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah, the Owen is maybe slightly better written, and the you know, Vanity Fair one, like, who still calls them rock musicians? Like, are you? What is your average age, Colapinto? But I think the VF piece may give a better sense of the money at stake and why this is not just like. It is a very, very Vanity Fair topic, like possibly Felonious Goss among the sort of like hushed rich hallways of Europe, like European royalty, that like so rich you've never heard of them. I did like that both of them clocked the barrister and CEO for basically like being too into bridge while his company was swirling the drain.
I didn't even mention that he was actually at one of the national bridge tournaments when Barrister's stock went from whatever 100 to 2 in one day.
Yeah. The phrase distracted and unreachable pretty much sold that. But yeah, they're both excellent. Again, we'll link them in the show notes. And I think that, you know, if you really only have time or enough Condé Nast unpaid views left in the month, and you could only read one, I guess the Vanity Fair, but I liked them both and I didn't think they were redundant.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of bridge, John, plug your shit.
well, as might not be a surprise. In my third career, I am now a professional bridge teacher and player. And if bridge is of interest to you and you ever want to know more about it, possibly even get into it, who knows? You can find my teaching website at losangelesbridgelessons.com. Just four words, no spaces. And yeah, check me out.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, I'll probably be talking about the Harvey Weinstein documentary on Hulu, I'll probably be talking about Murder in the Bayou on Showtime, and I'll definitely be talking about that Robert Chambers documentary series on Sundance, but that's not till November. Stay tuned. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? You can find me on social media, at Blotter Presents everywhere, and at Eve Beatty's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence. That's bestevidence.fyi. And don't forget, if we get 2,000 paid subscribers on that bad boy, we will cover the Theranos trial in person. If you like the podcast, I would love it if you would tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find us. If you don't like the podcast, I would love it if you would keep that to yourself. My guest has been John Ramos, and he's on Twitter at CouchBaron. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.